Good morning and welcome to Grand Rounds. I'm Ken Rosenthal. It's my pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Dr. Eric Martin. Dr. Martin is assistant professor of medicine at the University of Miami and the Miami Transplant Institute, where he's transplant hepatologist and also serves as the medical director of the Living Donor Liver Transplant Program. He's triple boarded with active certification in internal medicine, gastroenterology, and transplant hepatology. He obtained his medical degree from St. George's University in Grenada, West Indies, after which time he returned home to Wisconsin to complete his internal medicine residency and GI fellowship at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He then went on to complete an advanced fellowship in transplant hepatology at the University of Miami, where he remained as staff. He is active in clinical research and has published numerous articles and book chapters. He's currently involved in several medical advisory boards, including American Liver Foundation. This morning, his topic is elevated liver enzymes. And this comes home near and dear to me because I've been practicing gastroenterology for over 30 years. And people come in, I get referred to me, and they have a slight elevation in their ALT, and it's like, okay, do I order a ceruloplasmin, and do I order iron studies? And everybody who gets referred to me when they have a slight elevation in one of their transaminases. And there's got to be some cost-effective way to approach these people. And just yesterday in the Red Journal, there was an article about people who incidentally found on an imaging to have fatty liver, and which is one of the most common causes of elevated liver enzymes. How far do you go to working them up? So it's a very, very important, relevant topic, and I think oftentimes we waste a lot of resources ordering every possible serology in the book, which is not necessarily important on every patient. So without further ado, let us welcome Dr. Martin. Thank you.
All right. Morning, everybody. Thanks again, Dr. Rosenthal, for the invitation and the introduction. Though I will say, sort of stole a little bit of the introduction, just as far as preface for the liver enzymes. This is something that we see not only as consultants, but also primary care and things like that. So I think overall, it's a very pertinent talk, but it's a very big talk. So I'm really trying to simplify it and try to give a very good methodical and overview on just how to handle these patients. The objectives of the talk here, we're going to identify again the components of the liver biochemistry profile and really understanding their meaning, if abnormal. Also identify and understand the significance of the true liver function tests, the LFTs, because quite often I think it's a misnomer where people think that it's actually, well, they comment on it being the LFTs, but in fact it's not. Also develop a good differential diagnosis for abnormal liver biochemistries, especially paying special interest to significantly elevated AST, ALT of more than 1,000. So there's a very more of a specific diagnosis for that. But again, ultimately bringing this all together is really just have a good organized approach on how to manage and how to approach these patients. As Dr. Rosenthal had mentioned, again, abnormal liver enzymes in an otherwise healthy patient can be very challenging, even for the most experienced clinician. So much so that, again, it's not necessary to pursue a very extensive evaluation, even just for the most trivial elevated liver enzymes, due to the unnecessary expenses and, quite honestly, the risks of various procedures that may be involved. But on the other hand, if you fail to identify an otherwise treatable disease, obviously that's a big mistake. But liver enzymes, again, we check these all the time. They're in all the routine labs that we do and very readily available. Upwards of 9% of patients completely asymptomatic will have some sort of abnormality on liver profile tests. So how much we work that up and to what extent, again, is sort of the crux of the talk. Now, as far as the following tests here are really recommended by the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease and the National Academy of Clinical Biochemistry here. So the AST, the ALT, alkaline phosphatase, total bilirubin, direct bilirubin, total protein, albumin, and PTINR. So these are labs we see all the time. But really, when you break it down here, at least initially here, markers of hepatocellular injury really are the AST, ALT. Now, as far as the alkaline phosphatase and bilirubin, again, these are markers of cholestasis. But when we're talking about true liver function tests or the LFTs, we're really talking just about albumin, PT, and INR, as well as bilirubin. So a little bit more on that later. But again, the actual labs, I mean, we order these all the time. So in addition to the basic metabolic panel is the comprehensive metabolic panel. And quite honestly, that's enough. That gives you in addition to the electrolytes from the basic metabolic panels, you're going to get the total protein, albumin, the globulins, AST, ALT, ELK-phos, and total bilirubin. But again, with Quest and LabCorp, they have all these other different tests that they name here as far as hepatic function panel. But again, it's a bit of a misnomer because really there's not that much that's actually the liver function in that. But again, at least it has that. So keep that in mind when you actually order these tests. So really, just as far as a starting point, anybody with elevated liver enzymes in an otherwise healthy patient really have to take that into account. I mean, first and foremost, repeat the test. It could just be a lab error. Maybe they're taking a little dehydrated. Maybe they took some Tylenol the night before, the morning of the test. You know, you're not going to do an exhaustive workup just based on one slightly trivial abnormality. But again, obviously, if it coincides with a marked elevation in enzymes after starting a new medication, obviously, then common sense. But can't stress enough, though, the next year, history and physical exam. You can learn so much, obviously, from just a good detailed history and physical exam, where, quite honestly, oftentimes you may be able to get the diagnosis prior to a little bit more of a detailed laboratory workup, again, predicated on the physical exam. Of course, appropriate abdominal imaging and liver biopsy if necessary. But really, once you are able to identify that this truly is a persistent abnormality in the labs, sort of the next step would be really to identify the pattern of liver injury, and then based on that, you're really going to see sort of the extent of the enzyme elevation. As far as sort of pattern recognition of the different liver disease categories, we alluded to this already here as far as hepatocellular. This is going to be predominantly an AST-ALT. Now, you may have, to some degree, ELK-phos and total bilirubin elevated, but again, predominantly it's AST-ALT. Again, cholestatic pattern, predominantly the alkaline phosphatase. Again, there may be some AST-ALT and maybe bilirubin. Mixed, pretty self-explanatory, both AST-ALT and as well as the ELK-phos may be elevated. And then again, isolated hyperbilirubinemia, we're going to talk about that a little bit later as well. But if you want to be a little bit more sort of objective about it here, looking at the pattern of liver enzyme injury, looking at the R ratio. So again, this is where there's a formula here. You're taking the ALT value, divided that by the actual upper limit of normal based on different labs, comparing that to the ALK-phos value as well as the upper limit of normal. So if you're looking at this specifically, or anything more than 5, this ratio more than 5, this really is a hepatocellular injury. That middle ground here, but between 2 to 5, again, this is more of a mixed pattern. But less than 5, this is pretty telling more for more of a cholestatic liver injury. So then, again, it's really important, obviously, framing the questions that you're asking the patient with regards to the history. And this goes across the board, regardless of the pattern of liver injury. So certainly age and ethnicity, if there's any risk factors. But first and foremost, the presence and signs, symptoms of chronic liver disease. Because, again, trying to see if there's evidence of cirrhosis rather than just an acute onset liver injury, that also gives you some idea as to the etiology as well. So if there's any evidence or history of itching or pruritus, jaundice, ascites, encephalopathy, or GI bleeding, okay, sort of stigmata of chronic liver disease. At the same time, any risk factors for viral hepatitis, intranasal as well as IV drug use, body piercings, tattoos, sexual history, transfusion history. We're still diagnosing patients with hepatitis C, though, gradually, you know, not as often as before. But again, keep in mind, blood transfusions were readily given up until 92, where hepatitis C was not actively screened in the blood bank. So patients with transfusion before 92 with elevated liver enzymes and cirrhosis, certainly you have to think hepatitis C. Also, presence of any sort of comorbidities, specifically related to fatty liver. As Dr. Rosenthal was saying, 1 out of 3 people walking down the street will have some degree of fat in the liver. Now, the risk factors for more significant infiltration or NASH of the liver, certainly are type 2 diabetes, hypertension, diabetes, and obesity. Obviously, if they have a history of underlying autoimmune disease, certainly concern for autoimmune hepatitis. If there's a history of emphysema in a patient who's not smoking, certainly you want to think of alpha-1 antitrypsin. Any sort of weird neuropsychiatric disease in a young patient with underlying liver disease, certainly we should also think of Wilson disease. I would imagine you're going to ask about the alcohol history, but again, that's very important. And we'll talk a little bit more about it later, but you know, their binging habits as well as just how much you're allowed to drink per day. For women, the average per week is about 14 standard drinks per week. Men, we get away with a little bit more, 21. And again, so that's standard drinks. So that's a shot of liquor, 4 ounces of wine, or a can of beer. And again, if there's any other history of autoimmune disease, so we're talking not only autoimmune hepatitis, but as well as PBC. Family history of genetic conditions, obviously predisposing to liver disease. We're talking hemochromatosis as well as Wilson disease. Chronic diarrhea or inflammatory bowel disease. Obviously, there's a connection with inflammatory bowel disease, but as well as celiac sprue, other thyroid disorders. And, you know, I think it's one of these that is somewhat relatively missed is congestive hepatopathy, just from the backflow of pressure from right-sided heart failure. Patient with heart failure and elevated liver enzymes, certainly don't want to miss congestive hepatopathy. So again, next here, we're just going to go through and talk a little bit in detail about the specific biochemistries for each of these liver patterns here. So starting here with the serum aminotransferase levels. So this is really the crux, again, of the liver enzymes. Here we're talking the AST, ALT. And collectively, these are the most sensitive markers, again, for hepatocellular injury. They're actual enzymes that are key contributors to the citric acid cycle. But what's important is these are fairly widely distributed enzymes. They're not just in the liver. AST predominantly certainly in the liver, but it's also in muscle, both cardiac and skeletal muscle, as well as the kidney, brain, pancreas, lung, leukocytes, and erythrocytes. ALT, and for me this was, you know, up until late in medical school, I always thought ALT was exclusively liver. It's not. I mean, also it is found in some degree in muscle as well. So keep that in mind. It's not just the AST. But typically for that reason, though, ALT compared to AST is a much more specific marker for liver injury. So oftentimes we'll look at the ALT for overall liver injury, but we'll talk again. There's a role for AST as well. So it's important, though, that, again, the actual increase in the level of the enzymes really reflects sort of two things going on: damage to the tissues that actually are rich in these enzymes, as well as causing some permeability problems to the membrane, which causes these enzymes to leak into the serum. But the degree of the elevation of these enzymes do not correlate with the extent of liver injury, so keep that in mind as well. And again, the half-life for the AST, it's much shorter than the ALT. So the ALT is going to hang around a little bit longer. And one thing, too, and this is sort of a personal pet peeve, is please, please do not use the term transaminitis. It's a very outdated term, and quite honestly, it doesn't mean anything. It means inflammation of the transaminases, and that's not even a term. But you see, even some of my colleagues will write it or mention it. So it's a pet peeve, but please, I encourage you, especially the students early or the interns and residents early in your careers, is try to just avoid this term going forward. All right, now as far as the reference range, again, so we're not talking so much about AST, it's really about ALT. And again, there's gonna be some variation between labs for the most part, but the agreed upon upper limit of normal for ALT in the healthy adults in males is 29 to 33, females a little bit lower, 19 to 25. But specifically, recent AASLD guidelines that came out with regards to management of hepatitis B, they specifically made recommendations for ALT for males 35 and females 25. So keep that in mind again when we see some of these other enzymes. But again, the, you know, we talked about this. The degree of the enzyme does not necessarily correlate with the extent of liver injury, but the degree of elevation does give us some insight into the etiology of the liver disease. And one thing, too, not going to talk too much about it, but acute liver failure. The definition of acute liver failure does not include the serum aminotransferase levels. So if somebody comes in with elevated, very high elevated liver enzymes, specifically the AST, ALT, it's not liver failure just based on that. The diagnosis is very specific, to the point where it's rapid development of hepatocellular dysfunction, which is defined by an INR of more than 1.5, and encephalopathy of any grade within 26 weeks of the onset of illness, regardless of ALT. So again, sort of subjective breakdowns or characterizations of the degree of the enzyme. So if they're sort of very borderline or mild or moderate, but again, we get the very high or severe cases. And again, this gives us an insight into possibly the etiology of the liver disease. But by and far, what we see most often is really these sort of borderline or mild to even moderate cases of liver enzymes. And here in bold, these, again, by far, these are the most common causes. So non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. As we mentioned again, one out of three people walking down the street will have fatty liver. Alcoholic liver disease, acute or chronic viral hepatitis, drug-induced liver injury or DILI. This is increasingly common. Autoimmune hepatitis, hemochromatosis, and really cirrhosis of any cause can give you some degree of liver enzyme abnormality. I'm not going to go ahead and read word for word each of the other ones here, but you can see there's a long list of even sort of borderline to mild causes of liver injury. So it would be careless to order tests for all of these, the initial visit for an ALT, for example, that's 2 times upper limit of normal. Someone's got to pay for it, but at the same time, you know, you could narrow this down in a very systematic way, and that's what we're going to try to do. So, but keep in mind, this is not all just, as we alluded to before, not all just from the liver. There's a lot of non-hepatic sources of elevated AST and ALT, specifically skeletal muscle damage, rhabdo, we see this a lot, especially after some strenuous exercise, cardiac muscle damage, thyroid disease, macro AST, where the AST is actually complexed with different immunoglobulins, IgG specifically, heat stroke, hemolysis, adrenal insufficiency, and anorexia. Now, on the other end of the spectrum here, as far as the more severe, severely elevated liver enzymes, the list is much shorter. So again, acute viral hepatitis, we see this more in hepatitis A, B, and keep in mind HSV as well. Ischemic hepatitis, the so-called shock liver or acute cardiogenic liver injury. Vascular disorders, but Chiari syndrome, where you have an acute obstruction of the veins that are leaving the liver with the hepatic veins and the proximal IVC. Toxins, again, drug-induced liver injury, specifically Tylenol, cocaine, Flaca. Anyone know what Flaca is? So I don't know if you've seen any cases, but we've seen a few cases of Flaca. We haven't seen a case for maybe a year or so, but typically, I mean, the cases I've been involved with have not ended well. Multi-organ failure, including liver failure. It's a horrible synthetic drug that's, unfortunately, it's still out there. Autoimmune hepatitis, acute biliary obstruction. Now, this is one that I think also is often missed, where you think biliary obstruction being more of a cholestatic injury because of the acute obstruction of bile, but at the same time, if you catch it early enough, you could have very significantly elevated serum aminotransferase levels that, after passing the stone, dramatically improve, much like the shock liver. But that's something that I think people often miss. Diffuse neoplastic infiltration of the liver, specifically if we're talking lymphoma or any other sort of widespread metastatic disease, whether it's breast, colon cancer, Wilson disease, and again, we talked about rhabdo and heat stroke. But keep in mind, when you have massively elevated liver enzymes, the list is much shorter. So you're not going to be evaluating somebody for alcoholic liver disease, you know, even autoimmune hepatitis. When they're this high, again, you've got a very short list that are bolded here. So a few other things that we look at here is not only the, you know, the elevation of the AST, but the pattern compared to ALT specifically. Oftentimes, ALT, again, is more elevated than AST. And this is sort of across the board, especially in chronic viral hepatitis and fatty liver disease. But when you have that AST to ALT more than one, again, the first thought is you're thinking, well, is this alcohol? It's a pretty good test for alcohol. But keep in mind, though, if the AST to ALT is more than one, but the AST is more than 300, this is not alcohol. That's too high than you would get from alcohol. So you need to look for something else. But typically, this ratio is most useful when the AST is less than 300. So specifically, when it's more than two, it's pretty suggestive of alcoholic liver disease. And as a student, I always remembered AST, a scotch and tonic, makes sense. Now, once you're talking more than three, the ratio, and this is really suggestive of alcoholic liver disease. And the reason is because is there's a deficiency in the enzyme pyridoxal 5-phosphate in patients with alcoholic liver disease, and the ALT needs that more than the AST. So that's why the AST is specifically lower in alcoholic patients. There's a few other indexes that are used, the computer-based here. This is a Mayo scoring system. If there's some confusion or concern, is this alcohol versus fatty liver? It's a novel scoring system that can distinguish the two. It's best and most accurate when the MELD score is less than 20. But again, if you're just by putting in AST, ALT, the MCV, weight, height, and gender of a patient, it can calculate the probability of alcoholic liver disease. So for example, just plugging in some numbers, patient that is not all that uncommon, an AST here of 125, ALT 55, MCV 101, gentleman's 5'10", 205 pounds, ANI of 9.2, that correlates to 100% probability that this patient has alcoholic liver disease. So we use this sometimes when we know the patient's lying. You know, before we start threatening with a liver biopsy, and then, you know, they'll sort of confess. But it's a well-validated study, and it's hard to – obviously nothing's 100%, but 100% is pretty striking. LDH, you know, it's also included in a lot of these lab panels that we look at, and quite honestly – I used to ignore it, you know, as a resident. But I think there's some good meaning to LDH. It's a ubiquitous enzyme. It's all over. But the activity is very high in patients with ischemic hepatitis in particular, patients that have significant neoplastic involvement of the liver. So it's helpful, again, when you're early in the diagnosis, if you're thinking that there's some sort of viral hepatitis, and you're not sure. So this ratio ALT to LDH, I think clinically there's some role for it. So again, if the LDH is very high that you'd see in ischemic hepatitis, you know, you're going to have a ratio of less than 1.5. If it's more than 1.5, you're thinking more probably viral hepatitis. But again, at that point, you're going to be checking the viral serologies, and that's probably going to come back within the next 24, 48 hours, and you'll have your diagnosis anyways. So we talked about this already here as far as the physical exam. You're going to stop any sort of hepatotoxic medications. You're going to counsel them and educate them on alcohol cessation. You're going to assess all the risk factors that we talked about with regards to fatty liver and viral hepatitis. Routine labs, you're going to get your CMP, your CBC, and your PT and your INR. But the thing that I always remembered, one of my mentors in residency was what he referred to as the rules of three. So to me, it makes sense. So the three main causes of chronic liver disease, or even to some degree acute liver injury here, viral, autoimmune, and metabolic. And within each of those, again, you're going to be looking at hepatitis A. You check in for both IgM and IgG, not only because You want to see if the patient has acute hepatitis A, but at the same time, if they have chronic liver disease, you want to see the status of their immunity to hepatitis A because you're going to vaccinate them. Hepatitis B, certainly want to be checking the surface antigen antibody and the core antibody, both IgM and total. If positive, you're going to follow that up certainly with the DNA. Hepatitis C, same sort of thing. You're going to check with the antibody first. If positive, then you follow that up with an RNA. Now, as far as autoimmune, good place to start, just an ANA, anti-nuclear antibody, the ASMA, the anti-smooth muscle antibody, and the anti-mitochondrial antibody. I suppose for completeness, you could also put in there quantitative immunoglobulins. So again, you're specifically looking at IgM, which you're going to see more in PBC, and then IgG, which you're going to see more in autoimmune hepatitis. And then metabolic. So here you're going to be looking at the iron panel as well as ferritin. You're going to be screening for the transferrin saturation. Anything more than 45% is sort of a positive screen. And then you're going to follow that up with the HFE gene looking for hemochromatosis. But keep in mind, I think that's often sent, I don't say inappropriately, but in patients, alcoholic patients, their ferritin is going to be elevated, right? So you're going to be, that's just because of the secondary iron overload from alcohol. So, you know, if there's a family history of iron overload, you're going to be sending the genetic testing anyways. But keep in mind, a lot of these alcoholic patients are going to be having elevated ferritin anyways. Ceruloplasmin, Wilson disease, again, start with the ceruloplasmin, but in and of itself, it's not a great marker, but it's a good place to start because that also could be elevated in chronic liver disease by itself. But if it's low or borderline, you're going to follow that up with a 24-hour urine copper anyways, or even repeating the ceruloplasmin just to make sure. Alpha-1 antitrypsin, you know, there's some debate because you can check the serum, the actual level of the alpha-1 in the blood, or you check the phenotype. Personally, I just check the phenotype because that correlates pretty well with the risk of disease because, again, it could be an acute phase reactant, so it could be falsely elevated in somebody who clearly has a disease. So I think just checking the phenotype to see if they're, you know, SS, or ZZ, or any combination thereof would be a good place to start. So there's some other sort of tests that we can use short of a liver biopsy. And I think, so the FibroScan has been validated and shown to be very good, almost, and in some cases, as good as a liver biopsy. So I think we should be, do you have access to a FibroScan? Okay, great. I think it's a great device if you know how to use it. There's a learning curve to use it and to understand and to interpret it, but for those that aren't familiar with it, it's a fancy ultrasound. It's a non-invasive device that assesses the hardness or stiffness of the liver using a technique that's called transient elastography. And the whole premise is that liver hardness is evaluated by measuring the velocity of the vibration waves that are coming from the skin. And again, because the fibrous tissue in not necessarily cirrhosis, but any hepatitis or any inflammation of the liver, it's harder than a normal liver, so obviously this is what we can detect. So a couple different machines here, a couple different probes, both portable and basically you're going to be doing it here between the ribs on the side of the liver. And this is sort of the printout. This is the actual report that is generated. So you should do at least 10 different measurements. And the goal is to have a success rate where you actually get an appropriate reading of at least 60% and an interquartile range of less than 25%. So as far as the variance. So it gives you a couple things here. So this is the elastogram, which actually basically gives you the idea of the stiffness, and then the CAP on the other side. And we'll talk what this means, but this is sort of the scoring card for FibroScan. And again, it's been validated so well that they're able to break it down based on the disease etiology. A FibroScan number or stiffness number for somebody with fatty liver disease is a little bit different than somebody with chronic cholestatic disease. So here are the numbers here. So oftentimes, so for example, if the result is 11 kilopascals, for example, in a patient with hepatitis B, that's very concerning for F4, stage 4 fibrosis. So this is also, it's a tool that we use to screen patients. And this is sort of the studies that are ongoing. Somebody with fatty liver disease, if they don't lose weight and they continue to have uncontrolled medical comorbidities, last year you do a fiber scan, and they're about 8. You do it in a year, and now they're 9 or 10. Obviously, the progression to cirrhosis is a real concern. So this is one of the way that these can be used. But they're getting better, and it's not just looking at fibrosis or scar tissue, but now with the controlled attenuation parameter, they can actually now evaluate steatosis or fat with a fair amount of accuracy. To the point where, again, this CAP score, if it's more than 290, for example, that corresponds very closely with stage 3 or grade 3 steatosis without the need for biopsy. Anyone familiar with this website? Show of hands. No one's ever used this website? One. Okay. Well, this website... I implore you to use it, because this is, there are days where I've used this maybe 5-10 times a day. It's fantastic. So it's coming from the NIH, so livertox.nih.gov. This is what it looks like here. You enter any drug, and it will give you any case report, the biochemistry, the pattern of liver injury, the outcomes and the management. It's updated very actively. And this is the sort of, so drug-induced liver injury is something that we see so common. And some of these medications that you don't normally see, that's where that their website is useful. But this is actually based off of this website where they just sort of rank the top 100 medications that are increased risk for drug-induced liver injury. So not putting them all on here, but when you break it down here, a lot of what we see, antibiotics, for example, Augmentin, and it's not the amoxicillin, it's the clavulanic acid. That's the actual component of the antibiotic that causes the liver injury, and typically that's more of a cholestatic pattern. Minocycline, nitrofurantoin, Bactrim, sulfasalazine. So these are very common antibiotics that we see. Amiodarone, certainly. Antimicrobials, isoniazid, ketoconazole, rifampin, but also Dilantin and valproic acid. Well, there's a long list here. So these are, anytime somebody's on these medications and they have elevated liver enzymes, good chance that this is the case. But at the same time, common things being common, you need to rule out other things as well. So certainly patients that have autoimmune hepatitis could develop drug-induced liver injury. They're not mutually exclusive, so you have to keep that in mind. And there's all these other fancy online tests and things. There's the NAFLD fibrosis score. That's it's an online calculator that just puts in different variables. There's the fibrosis 4, the Fib4 score. Again, it's another online calculator that gives you an idea if there is fibrosis based on age, platelet count, AST, ALT. Again, these are ideas to use, not to replace a liver biopsy, but again, it's just a good discussion to have with the patients on the disease. So moving forward more to now cholestasis. So it's a different sort of disease pathogenesis here. So really cholestasis, it comes from the defect in bile synthesis, bile flow or secretion, or again, any sort of obstruction to bile. And the main marker, indirect marker of cholestasis is alkaline phosphatase. But when in doubt, there's a few other enzymes that also reflect cholestasis, and that's 5 nucleotidase and the GGT. It's an enzyme, again, we don't know exactly how it works, as is often the case with so much of what we do. But likely it has... It certainly has some degree of secretory mechanism on the level of the biliary epithelium. But again, it's not just found in the liver. Found, obviously, quite a bit in the bone, but as well as intestine, kidney, placenta, and white blood cells as well. So, there's a variation in normal, 20 to 140, but again, different times in lives here. Younger patients, obviously, because of the bone growth, you're going to have an elevated alkaline phosphatase. That doesn't necessarily mean you have underlying liver disease. Late in pregnancy, because of the placenta, isoenzyme obviously will be elevated. And there's some evidence that patients with blood type O and B after a fatty meal will have increased ALK phos. Clinically, that's not a significant thing, but keep that in mind. But in and of itself, again, it's not completely specific for cholestasis. Again, it could be present in a underlying hepatocellular injury as well. But really, once you get more than four times the upper limit of normal, again, about 120 or so, that's where you really need to think more of a cholestatic pattern, whether this is more of an infiltrative liver disease or, again, rapid bone turnover. So if you really don't know if this is a liver etiology of the ALK phos or if this is some sort of non-hepatic cause, this is where you would check the other tests, the GGT and the 5' nucleotidase, and that'll give you a better idea. Again, this is 5-nucleotidase. It's an enzyme that is not seen in bone, and it's more specific to the biliary epithelium as well as GGT. But the problem with GGT is, you know, before everyone thought that this was just associated with alcoholic liver disease, but it's not. Again, it's very nonspecific. But the main thing, again, it's not elevated in bone disease. So, again, it helps you sort of differentiate the two. Again, here, non-hepatic causes of elevated alkaline phosphatase. We talked a little bit about this as well. But any sort of bone disease, osteomyelitis, healing fractures, malignancy, renal function as well, heart failure, hyperthyroid as well as hyperparathyroidism, and any sort of underlying malignancy. Keep that in mind. All right, so now the causes of elevated alkaline phosphatase, again, really the crux of this is cholestasis. So is this intrahepatic versus extrahepatic? So if it's intrahepatic, again, overlap on a lot of what we saw already, but again, drug-induced liver injury, viral hepatitis. But the main ones that are more unique to the cholestatic realm of things are PBC, primary biliary cholangitis. Now this used to be called primary biliary cirrhosis, but now it's changed officially to cholangitis. Granulomatous liver disease, sarcoidosis, for example. PSC. So specifically, if we're talking intrahepatic, we're talking the small duct PSC. And we see this a lot, the ICP, the intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, later in pregnancy. Infiltrative disease, amyloidosis, as well as lymphoma, keep that in mind. TPN, lots of patients on TPN will have some degree of cholestasis. Alkaline phosphatase oftentimes is certainly it's elevated. Don't forget sepsis, specifically cholestasis of sepsis. These are the sick patients in the ICU. These are oftentimes difficult to treat infections. For example, osteomyelitis. Patients variably will have some degree of cholestasis. And again, whether that's offset by the bone disease and things, but again, there's bilirubin oftentimes is elevated in those patients as well. And again, if we're talking more extrahepatic cholestasis here, choledocholithiasis, bile duct stones, malignancy, but large duct PSC. So if you have dominant strictures in the common bile duct or the hepatic ducts as well. So in addition to the labs that we talked about before, imaging, always start with an ultrasound. You know, the emergency room sometimes will jump right to a CT scan, and then you go back to do an ultrasound, and you can pick up things on an ultrasound that the CT may have missed, you know, specifically stones and things like that. So, again, we're looking at here as an example of intrahepatic ductal dilation. So this is obviously would suggest more of an extrahepatic, whether it's a stone, a stricture, some sort of compression. So always start with an ultrasound. ERCPs, oftentimes it's used, but it's being a little bit more replaced by the MRCP, which is much less invasive. And diagnostically, it's as good as an ERCP. But again, the benefit of an ERCP is it's also therapeutic, obviously. So this is what a normal ERCP looks like with a very nice and patent common bile duct and the cystic duct here, and then the hepatic ducts. But when you're looking at it for PSC, for example, again, MRCP is very useful. So you sort of see the discontinuity here of the bile ducts, and this is just a mess here. All the intrahepatic beading, the classic beading that you'll see, and you can also see that here on the ERCP as well. So here on the ERCP, I mean, there's no main dominant stricture. There's nothing to stent. There's nothing to dilate. This is all deep within the liver. So there's really no therapeutic approach with ERCP, oftentimes with the small duct PSC. Anybody with PSC and they have this very long stricture, certainly it's a concern for cholangiocarcinoma. So keep that in mind as well. All right. Bilirubin is sort of the last main topics here. But, you know, bilirubin, again, it's one of these that sort of is seen in each of the different, the entire spectrum of liver injury, whether it's hepatocellular, isolated, or cholestatic. So it's really important to have a good idea of what bilirubin is and where it comes from. So it's the end product of heme. Heme catabolism that occurs in the reticular endothelial cells of the spleen and the liver. So you're breaking down hemoglobin. Eventually that turns into bilirubin. But it's more to it than that because bilirubin, as you know, exists. There's two different forms of bilirubin. It's the unconjugated, which roughly correlates to the indirect bilirubin. And then you have the conjugated bilirubin, which again correlates to the direct bilirubin. So initially, bilirubin is unconjugated, so it's insoluble in water. Because it's not soluble in water, to be soluble, it needs to bind. It binds to albumin. Albumin then transports it to the liver, but this is a very important step here in the metabolism of bilirubin. It becomes conjugated, thereby becoming soluble in water by this very important enzyme here, UDP, glucuronyl transferase. So sort of a long slide here, but basically what happens is it's once it becomes conjugated, and to this point everything was is a very passive process. The only ATP-dependent transport part of this whole metabolism is when bilirubin is transported from the bile ducts into the bile. And that's important because even patients with fulminant liver failure will have predominantly conjugated bilirubin because the ATP, again, it's not getting out into the bile, but it's already conjugated because that's not an energy-dependent process. So what happens once it's into the bile, it goes all the way down to the terminal ileum or the colon. And what's going to happen is it's then broken down by various bacteria where it becomes unconjugated and further reduced by some of the other bacteria. So this urobilinogen by itself, it's colorless. So it may be reabsorbed, but oftentimes this will be broken down further, and that's what gives us the sort of the characteristic brown color of our stool. Part of it then can be reabsorbed, maybe enter some of the enterohepatic circulation, but will find its way into the urine. And again, that's what gives urine its color, the urobilin. But again, this is just another sort of try to bring everything together. Unconjugated bilirubin is never in the urine because, again, in the serum, it's bounded to albumin, and albumin is not readily filtered by the glomeruli. So if there is bilirubin in the urine, you know that it is conjugated hyperbilirubinemia and suggestive of underlying hepatobiliary disease. So keep that in mind. So knowing that, then it makes sense as far as the different causes of hyperbilirubinemia, right? So you can have overproduction of bilirubin because of the excessive breakdown of hemoglobin, whether this is hemolysis, a big blood clot. You can have impaired uptake, conjugation, or excretion of bilirubin. And then you could have sort of abnormal regurgitation of cycling of the bilirubin from the hepatocytes and the bile ducts. But again, jaundice really doesn't develop until your bilirubin is at least about 3. Typically, you see that first in the eyes as well as underneath the tongue. But again, you can't tell if this is direct or indirect just based on jaundice. So another sort of misnomer that I want to dispel today is it's not scleral icterus, and I spelled that, I apologize. It's conjunctival icterus, all right? And this is, it's been perpetuated in medical texts for decades. And, I mean, it, histologically, this is something that you can tell because bilirubin has a very high affinity for elastin. So elastin is very abundant protein in the conjunctiva, not in the sclera. So, you know, we're not going to use transaminitis. We're not going to use scleral icterus. We're going to use conjunctival icterus. All right? So, so it's important, too, because the evaluation of isolated hyperbilirubinemia is very different. Again, than hyperbilirubinemia that's associated with underlying pedocellular injury. So it's a very separate sort of etiology. So first, anybody with isolated elevations in their bilirubin, you want to fractionate it out. So you really want to see how much is conjugated and how much is unconjugated. So the general rule of thought is if the direct bilirubin is less than 15% of the total bilirubin, safe to say that this is a indirect hyperbilirubinemia process. So, and that certainly narrows it down. Because here, if, again, you fractionate it out, more than 15%, if more than 15% of the bilirubin is direct, and oftentimes it's much more than that, if it truly is going to be a direct process, it narrows it down. There's not a lot of things that actually do this, right? So this is going to be the things we read about, I've never seen. But again, the textbooks want you to know the inherited direct hyperbilirubinemias as far as the Dubin-Johnson syndrome and Roeder syndrome. So again, because it's conjugated, it's not getting transported out properly, but it's being conjugated correctly within the cells. So you can tell sort of where in the biliary bilirubin metabolism the breakdown is. But it gets a little bit more confusing on the other side. So if it's predominantly indirect, the most common cause is hemolysis. So you want to be very thorough and do a complete hemolysis workup. So you're checking for haptoglobin, LDH, reticulocyte count. You're going to look at a peripheral smear. If that's present, obviously, this is some sort of hemolytic disorder. If it's negative, next thing should really be medications. And again, there's not a long list of medications that can cause hemolysis, but you should be very thorough. But if there's no evidence of medications that can cause that, more than likely, large majority of the time, it's going to be Gilbert's disease. Okay, and this is a benign condition where it's indirect hyperbilirubinemia. 6 to 12% of patients will have this. There's absolutely no other follow-up that needs to be done, no serial imaging. You don't need to check liver enzymes every month. If it truly is isolated, elevated bilirubin, and everything else has been ruled out, Gilbert's disease, and you're done. All right, moving on a little bit to more of the liver function. So albumin, very important. We use it all the time. We check for it all the time. It's a protein that's exclusively produced in the liver. So it does a lot of things. It helps with the oncotic pressure. It binds a lot of other substances, like we talked about, the unconjugated bilirubin, certainly the metabolism of compounds, as well as various antioxidant properties. The normal range is about 3.5 to 4.5. But one thing with the albumin, though, keep in mind, it has a very long half-life. So it's sometimes it's difficult to interpret albumin because of the long half-life, especially in acute liver injury. Now, if it's chronic liver injury, because of the long half-life, that does give us some understanding to perhaps there's some sort of chronic liver disease going on. So much so that if you have a decreased albumin in a patient with chronic liver disease, you really should be concerned that maybe this patient has developed cirrhosis. But again, low albumin does not necessarily just mean it's not specific to liver disease by itself, because there's other situations where you can have a decrease in albumin concentration, specifically nephrotic syndrome, where you do have injury to the kidneys and are losing albumin in the protein or in the urine, malabsorption, protein losing enteropathies, as well as any sort of SIRS associated with chronic infections as well. Lastly here, I'm going to talk about prothrombin time and INR. So the liver is a major site of a synthesis of essentially all the main blood coagulation proteins. Okay, so we're talking 1, 2, 5, 7, 9, 10, 12, and 13. The major exception, though, is factor 8, which is produced mainly in vascular endothelial cells. So this is, again, depending on how academic you want to be sometimes, if there's a question if this patient is having DIC, if this is, liver, if it's really just progression of the liver failure, or if it's DIC with an otherwise normal liver, you can check a factor 8. And if the factor 8 is normal, then, that may tell you that this may be a liver problem. Keep that in mind. But again, because it's made in the liver, this is one of the liver function tests. So how we interpret this gives us some insight as to the function of the liver. But again, there's lots of things that can cause, not a lot of things, just a few here that I listed, that can cause an elevation in the INR in the absence of liver disease. Certainly if there's any congenital deficiency of some of these clotting factors. Obviously if you're on Coumadin, if some sort of consumptive process where you have a massive GI bleed or DIC, or again, if there's vitamin K deficiency. So, and that's important, obviously, because there are vitamin K-dependent clotting factors, specifically 2, 7, 9, and 10, that if deficient in vitamin K will cause an increase in or a prolongation in PT and INR. But again, there's several things to keep in mind that could cause a decrease in vitamin K. Alcoholics don't have a very good diet. So alcoholic patient with liver disease that has an elevated INR, that could very easily be reversed with just supplementing dietary vitamin K. Fat absorption, various gut flora altering antibiotics, as well as chronic cholestasis, that can all cause deficiencies in vitamin K. So any patient with that you see, inpatient or even outpatient, but inpatient, if they have vitamin K or if they have an elevated INR, even if they have underlying liver disease, give them a trial of vitamin K. So typically this can be given as sort of a slow infusion of vitamin K, and 10 milligrams once a day for 3 days is enough to completely replete the vitamin K stores. So again, in an alcoholic patient, if the INR improves after giving the vitamin K, well, then it's probably just a vitamin deficiency. If they have malabsorption, you can't give oral vitamin K, though you could perhaps to alcoholic liver disease. That's why you have to give the IV. Now, in a patient who has chronically elevated INR because of the liver disease, or even acute liver failure where the INR is elevated, vitamin K will not reverse this. So again, it's sort of a therapeutic, but also it's prognostic. And on that note as well, if somebody does have elevated INR with liver failure, like we talked about, so a patient who's encephalopathic with an INR of 1.5, who's not bleeding, do not give FFP because it obscures the prognostic marker of the INR. Now, if they're bleeding, that's one thing. But you want to see the INR go from 1.5 to 2 to 2.5 because, again, that's very prognostic. Vitamin K, that's fine because, again, the vitamin K, if it's liver disease, isn't going to turn that around anyways. So don't be afraid of vitamin K. One last thing here I want to mention. Again, cholestasis by itself can cause prolongation in the PT and the INR. And that's just because you're having a decrease in the bile flow, right? So because of a decrease in the bile flow, that's not going to bring in the appropriate bile salts, and that's going to result in malabsorption of the fat-soluble vitamins, of which here, obviously, is vitamin K. So sort of extrapolating this to, PT and INR, obviously, INR, it's devised more and validated to really look at patients that are on various vitamin K antagonists, Coumadin. But in and of itself, it's not a good and accurate measure for the risk of bleeding in patients, especially with liver disease. And at the same time, an elevated INR does not provide protection. It's not protective against portal vein thrombus and DVT. So if a patient with cirrhosis is in the hospital and they're somewhat bedbound and their INR is 1.9 or 2, you would still want to give them DVT prophylaxis, depending on what their platelets are. So go ahead and give them heparin, give them Lovenox. Because as this slide shows, they're in this very sort of fragile equilibrium with their with the coagulation profile. Because a lot of the procoagulant proteins, as we talked about, the clotting factors, are decreased in cirrhosis because of its synthetic function. But also, as for example, vitamin or a protein S and protein C, those are the anticoagulant proteins. These are also decreased. So there's sort of this fine balance. So if there's something that tips it over, and sometimes it's hard to say what that is, patients with cirrhosis develop portal vein thrombosis all the time, even in elevated INR. So, you know, you can't ignore the fact that these patients can very well throw a blood clot, even if their platelets are low, even if their INR is elevated. But like I talked about before, again, the INR is one of their true liver function tests. It's very prognostic. So unlike albumin that we talked about because of the long half-life, the PT is very helpful in acute liver dysfunction because some of the half-life of some of these clotting factors are hours. So you can get a good idea as to what's going on right now. And because of the high prognostic value, it's included in a lot of these prognostic models that we use every day, specific to acute liver failure, King's College criteria, the MADRI discriminant function, where we're calculating that in addition to bilirubin and other things to get an idea, the severity of alcoholic hepatitis. It's also used in the child score system. But again, you know, it's in the MELD score, which we use 20, 30 times a day. So it's very prognostic, and so have a good understanding of INR, I think, is really important. I think this may be sort of a wrap-up slide. So bringing it all back, because, again, as a hepatologist, it's oftentimes easy to evaluate these patients because a lot of the workup oftentimes has already been done. So, you know, as primary carers and hospitalists and internal medicine physicians, you know, you're sort of at the front line, so to speak. So really getting a very systematic approach to the workup of this is obviously the most important. But when do you then refer these patients to a hepatologist? Well, I mean, certainly when the diagnosis is confirmed and there's obvious specific treatment, whether it's PBC, autoimmune hepatitis, and patients where, despite the workup we've done, is there still a question as to what's going on? Obviously, that's a time to refer. Does the patient need a liver biopsy? Any other sort of workup that needs to be done? Does the patient throughout this actually found to have cirrhosis? Even if the liver enzymes may normalize or relatively low, certain things need to be done for patients with cirrhosis. They need to be screened for liver cancer at least every 6 months with AFP, with an ultrasound. They need to have endoscopic evaluation or for varices to make sure there's no variceal hemorrhage and things like that. But again, if the course is sort of rapidly progressing, obviously you want to you want to refer the patient before they develop acute liver failure. Obviously, you know, for obvious reasons, but you know, circling back to what Dr. Rosenthal was saying as far as a fatty liver, I mean, this is one of these things that it's kind of like hepatitis C, where hepatitis C is everybody's in the very near future will be able to treat hepatitis C. I think it's probably going to be done a lot more often in primary care, to be quite honest, because it's pretty easy. It's a pill once a day for 8 to 12 weeks. I don't think you necessarily need to be seen by a hepatologist to do that. But again, a lot of these people have cirrhosis, so there's a reason to be seen. But for fatty liver, because it's so common, other than maybe some research studies that are coming out with the antifibrotic agents, the treatment for fatty liver is weight loss, 8 to 10% of weight loss, and controlling all the medical comorbidities that they have, the high blood pressure, the diabetes, the cholesterol. So unless there's evidence of advanced hepatic fibrosis as seen on a fibroscan, ultrasound, or a biopsy, You know, not every patient with fatty liver, I think, necessarily needs to go to hepatology. But then at the same time, I think primary care is going to get overwhelmed with a lot of these liver or fatty liver patients. So, you know, not everyone needs to go, but certainly some that are a little bit more advanced. And one thing just wanted to mention, there's the handout in the back. This is something that we're promoting here with University of Miami, and the Miami Transplant Institute is what's called the liver failure team. So on the back side of this, which is again available at the front, these are all the personal cell phones of all the physicians that are involved with the transplant service. But again, not just transplant, again, if there's any evidence of liver failure, whether this in patients in need of the ICU or just more involved management on the floors, or if they need assistance with providing follow-up or just getting plugged into the liver clinic in general, or if you just have a question about, you know, how to evaluate something, feel free. This is it's not an automated system. It's somebody actually answering the phone who then transfers it over to the on-call physician. But on the other line, on the other side of this, again, it's just the direct numbers with all of our cell phones. So please do not hesitate to call if there's any question, again, whether it's a transfer, outpatient, referral, or otherwise. And again, sort of as a conclusion, everything we talked about here, asymptomatic abnormalities of liver enzymes are obviously not uncommon. The true LFTs, again, albumin, INR, and bilirubin. And so much of what you can do to determine an etiology can really be honed in after a good detailed physical exam and history, no doubt. Obviously, the recognition of the pattern of liver injury goes a long way to breaking down the etiologies. Though the three most common causes of elevated liver enzymes, alcohol, fatty liver, and drug-induced liver injury. And then again, what I always teach the students and the residents is a sort of rule of three as a good starting point to work up chronic liver disease. All right, and with that, I thank you. Question. So we do adults as well as pediatrics, not as much pediatrics, but in general, last year I believe we were 120 total liver transplants. Yeah. Any other questions? All right. All right, thank you.